Mormon Stories is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormonstories.org and clicking on the donate button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Stories are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support.
Circling gloom, lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Sean DeLynn. Today we are going to be interviewing an amazing couple with an amazing child. The couple is Meg and Jake Abhow. They live in Phoenix, and they have a son, and the son's named John. Is that right, Daniel?
Yeah, that's right.
And what's amazing about Meg and Jake is that, you know, they were raised LDS, strong in the church, very committed, and they discovered that their son, John, was gay. Daniel, I want to say around age 13 or so. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what I love about Jake and Meg's story is that they have just been fiercely supportive of their son and just so strongly committed to their son's well-being and making sure that their son grows up in a healthy, affirming environment.
I've met a lot of parents in the past couple of years through my different advocacy, and there have been some fantastic examples of Mormons parents who have really done the right thing for their LGBT kids and really saved their lives and got them started in a really good direction in life. And it is hard, though, and there's a lot of parents who need more resources. I've also worked a lot with some other parents who aren't believing or aren't active anymore, and the journey, you know, that families go through is very interesting, and I have to say for a lot of them it takes them out of the church. But I have to say I've met both, you know, in the church and out of the church. I've met some amazing parents, and what they do have in common is that they really get it, that their child, they really got to watch out for the health and kind of have to let go of a lot of the ideas they might have had prior to learning that their daughter and son is LGBT.
And also, Daniel, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, even though the United States and even in areas of the church has become more affirming, we still have a problem of LDS youth, LGBT youth, non-LDS youth, who sometimes take their own lives. I just want to also say that one of the intents of this video is to help friends and family become the types of allies that would keep our young LGBT brothers and sisters from harming themselves or taking their own lives. And I think that's an important purpose of this video.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that is really all of our primary motivation for being involved in any of this, is that we've got to stop the suicides, and that's got to come by getting to the parents.
Right.
And
right.
So that's why I'm really hoping everybody will at least help Mormon parents understand the importance of being loving to their LGBT children.
Then I hope you guys will enjoy Meg and Jake and John Abhow. It's also important to know that we hope to get this interview also in video up on YouTube/Mormon Stories. So check us out there as well. And then finally, Daniel, if this is right, the listeners will notice that in the first part of the interview, you're not asking questions audibly, but then in the second part you are. And that's just an artifact of the fact that you did the interviews at two different times.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to know that I did interview them at two different times. They were about 6 months apart. And they were at different stages in their journey at those times. So the second one was sort of more in line with a typical Mormon Stories podcast. The first one, yeah, you'll notice that my voice is absent. We edited that out because I wasn't speaking in an interview format with them.
So here goes a wonderful interview with Daniel Parkinson and the Abhows. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks, John.
My name is Meg Abhow, and I was born and raised in the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I have 10 sisters and 5 brothers, and I was raised in the gospel. And I met my husband, Jake, in 1996, and we got married in 1998 in the Bountiful Temple. And we raised our son, John. We have one child. His name is John, and we raised him in the church. And that's...
Yeah, so I'm Jake, we've been married for almost 16 years. My parents, I have one brother. My parents were baptized into the church when we were about 8 or 9, where the missionaries tracked us out, knocked on our door. We were baptized about 3 weeks later. And then my brother and I both went on missions. I served a mission in Montreal in Canada. And they came home and found Meg, and then we got married.
Well, John was born in 1999. I don't know if this is relevant. You can cut this out. I was told that I could never have kids. And so when John came along, I think we were just barely married, not really ready for it. But
we found out on Christmas Day.
Yeah, Christmas Day, a little Christmas miracle. I found out that we were expecting. And so, of course, I was terrified because I'm going to be 21 and have a baby. And we felt like babies ourselves. But we're so excited. He was born in August of 99, and we blessed, Jake blessed him at my sister's baptism, because all my family was there, and we were just over the moon, just in love with him from the second we met him, and just raised him up. And I always had callings in young women. I'm just like the perpetual young women leader. I was from secretary to young women's president and everywhere in between. So I was always carting my little baby around to all of the activities and basically I think I have my PhD in young women. So, I mean, it was like 15 years of young women. And John was just loved church. He was so cute in his tie, and we took him to church, and he loved nursery. He just, bye mom, bye dad. He never had any issues in nursery, and everybody loved him in primary, and he was always like everybody's favorite. He's just so sweet.
Yeah, so we were married in 1998, and we had, and then John was born. But for me, prior to that, we were baptized. I was 9 years old when we were baptized. And then as we, a couple years later, my father, who had rapidly progressed in the church, I guess you could say, he was a 70 at the local area, the stake level when they had 70s. He was diagnosed with leukemia, and he passed away when I was 13. And so my brother and I were kind of forced to, I guess, look at the world a little bit differently at a young age. But when I originally was called on my mission, I was actually called to go to the Ivory Coast in West Africa. And I went over there, and in the Ivory Coast, they have the men in the Ivory Coast have a, I don't know if it's a tradition or what you would call it, but for two men, if they're very, very close, a sign of friendship is they would hold each other's hands, or they would just kind of touch the arm or something like that as they're walking together. And in the missionary training center, they actually use the word warned us of this, you know, but really, they kind of gave us the idea that might be the case, and just have not be shocking or whatnot. And this was 1992. And so I went out there, and my mission companion was a local. He lived in the Ivory Coast there. And so in fact, his mother lived right up the street from us, and we would go see her about once a week. But about 2 or 3 weeks in, we were walking down the street, and sure enough, he kind of grabbed my arm and then grabbed my fingers, you know, and it was really, really uncomfortable to me. You know, I was a little, you know, because I didn't really know what to expect, but I didn't dare show that emotion, you know. So I held my missionary companion's hand for, I don't know, we probably walked a couple of miles, you know, because I was, you know, I understood that it was a cultural thing and that I should feel honored for that, you know. And it was my culture that had taught me to be uncomfortable, which I was, but I didn't show that there. I got sick in the Ivory Coast and came home, and then since we were learning French there, they had me finish my mission in Montreal. But a couple years after that, I had a roommate who was gay as well, and he and I became very, very close friends, and we didn't, I intentionally did, I kind of skirted the subject, you know, it didn't really bother me or anything, but I didn't, it was something that I wasn't comfortable with, you know, so we didn't really talk about it, but I enjoyed him as a person, and he took me down to West Hollywood and showed me everything, you know, the whole lifestyle down there that I had no idea existed. And we used to talk, we would walk down the street, and I said, so does everybody here know that you're gay? And he goes, oh yeah. He goes, you know, it's really obvious. I said, do they think I'm gay? They think that we're together? He goes, oh no, everybody knows that you're straight. And I was like, well, how do people know? And so I just learned a little bit, little things here and there, you know, from this guy, and he's still a good friend. But yeah, so that's a little bit about my background anyway, leading up to when John told us about himself. I've had several gay friends in the past in my life I've kind of crossed paths with, but nobody that I ever stayed really long-term close with. And I think that was probably because of my views. I held very traditional conservative views on homosexuality and what it was. You know, that it was a sin, that it was wrong, and politically everything, you know, I still held tight to those views. But I did have a feeling of compassion towards the individual, you know, and that didn't add up completely in my head. But, you know, when I would go vote, you know, in politics, I typically went, you know, definitely the conservative Republican right. I don't know.
John was as far as the church goes and his activity in the church, he never even asked to miss Mutual. He never complained about going to activities or going to church or going. The only thing maybe he complained about was camping, because as far as like the traditional boy goes, John has never been your typical. He is not interested in sports, and he could basically he just has zero interest in sports, but he was very musical and very compassionate and loving and sweet, and could get along with anyone. And so he loved Mutual and all his friends at Mutual, and he loved passing the sacrament. And so he was like, I guess there's a term in our church, it's called Peter priesthood. So I guess John would be considered Peter priesthood, and everybody in the ward would always ask me, what do you do? What are your
you know, if I can say
parenting
too,
tips. Well, somebody, such a good kid.
Yeah, well, somebody in our ward even pulled me aside one day, he said every parent in our ward wishes that John was their kid, you know, or wishes that he was half as great as your son.
Yeah, and he was really loved.
Yeah, so at some level, he set a bar, you know, of what other parents were kind of like hoping that their kids would be like. And we hid him from media. We were really strict on what movies and TV shows that he could watch. And we were really, really tight on that.
Yeah, we were strict.
Yeah, and he never really had he would be a little bit upset that he couldn't watch this certain PG-13 movie that all the other kids at school were. But he was a good kid. He didn't sneak around and go try to watch stuff, or he'd tell us that he didn't watch this because everybody else was watching it. And
he didn't complain too much about it.
No.
But so just a typical kid he was just a typical Mormon kid, I guess. Mm-hmm. Just a really happy, sweet boy. Still, just happy, sweet boy. So you can maybe understand my. John was what some people say a bit effeminate. I didn't really see it. I think as a parent, you just don't notice these things. And I just thought he was different. Everybody's different. Everybody comes in all different shapes and sizes and personalities and characteristics. And I didn't label him. I didn't think anything of it. But in my mind, I saw John growing up and getting married and going on a mission and being married in the temple and just doing just basic, going to BYU, just your basic things that I think is pretty typical in our Mormon community. And so when he decided to come out to me, I was very shocked. He was 13 years old, and it was in March of 2013, and he said, I had rented a carpet cleaner because I was unsatisfied with the service that we had, and I have a bit of OCD, I guess you could say. So I'm cleaning these carpets, and it's super loud, and he said, "Mom, would you like to play a game of Hangman?" And he had the iPad, and I said, "Sure, no problem." But we couldn't really hear each other, so we started signing the letters to each other. And he's got this game of Hangman on the iPad, and I was just kind of getting focused on something in the carpeting, and he kind of clapped his hands at me and said, "Mom, this is really important. I need you to listen to me." So we're signing, and all of a sudden I realized it's not one long word, it's more of a phrase. And it said, "I am like Andy." And I said, "From the office?" And he just shook his head no, and the carpet cleaner's still going. And right over the top of that phrase, he wrote "gay." And I just turned the machine off, and I was like, my voice was shaking. And I was like, "Are you telling me that you're gay right now?" And he just shook his head like that, and he closed his eyes. And for information's sake, we have a good friend, Andy, who is gay. So he was saying, I was like our friend Andy, who John had never met in person, but it was my sister and Andy were going to be engaged. Well, immediately I turned the machine off, and I just don't remember exactly how long it took, but I think seconds, I hope seconds. I was across the room, and I just I just embraced him, and I said that I love you, John, and this will change nothing, and nothing could ever change, and we will figure this out, and I don't know what this means, and I don't have any answers, and then I just started bawling, because I think all of a sudden it was like, the selfish part in me didn't think of his beautiful future, of who he truly is. The selfish part of me just saw my grandchildren just float away in wisps, and his mission was just gone, and his temple marriage was gone, and everything that I had hoped for him was gone. I didn't understand. I didn't know. Jake, fortunately, had been exposed to a lot of gay people in his life. Myself, not at all. I didn't know anything about it. So we sat there hugging, and for a while, and I just was like, he said, "Mom, I don't want you to be sad." And I said, "John, I'm not sad. I'm not disappointed in you at all. I love you so much. I'm sad because I'm worried. I'm worried this will be a hard life for you." And from what I knew of gay people is that they were bullied, they were mistreated, and maybe a small part of me thought that it was a choice. I don't think I ever consciously thought that it was a choice, but I thought, here's this boy that's 13 and he is not choosing this. So I said, "Okay, how do you feel about this? How are you okay?" And because I thought maybe he wouldn't like this about himself, or that he would start to have low self-esteem. And I instantly kind of went into this like overprotective mother mode, which we affectionately call the mama dragon. And he said, "Mom, I'm okay with this. I feel like this is a special part of me, and I feel like I want to shout it from the rooftops. And he said something that's really cute is that he said, "So I've been doing a lot of research, and there's this thing called the closet." I said, "I know, I've heard of the closet." And I had mistakenly thought that the closet was to protect yourself, that because you weren't accepted from society, so you were going to be safe in the closet. But John told me that the closet is a place of darkness and loneliness and depression, and he didn't want anything to do with it. And he asked me within minutes of coming out if I could help him facilitate a coming out, if he could live authentically. So I really had to play catch up immediately. And I was said, John, I will support you in anything and we will do this. Whatever it takes, I need to learn some more things. And he was like, okay, you know, just take your time. And so Jake came up at that moment, and cause he had the carpet cleaning machine had stopped, and John and I are just still hugging and crying, both of us just crying. And
yeah, I was like, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, he comes in the room, and we were, John, it was in my room. And so we were sitting on my bed, just hugging, and Jake sits on the couch that was in our room. And he was like, guys, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, I'll go back a little bit and we can mesh these together. But, previous year, probably, Meg has a sister who lives here in Arizona with us, she and her daughter and John are almost exactly the same age, and they've kind of treated each other like twins, mm-hmm. you know, all growing up, and they're really, really close. Well, the two of them had become kind of activists in the LGBT community in the prior year, and we knew a little bit about that. We knew that, and but we were still really unfamiliar with it, because it wasn't something that we did. And it was still part of that thing for me. I was still a little bit uncomfortable with that whole idea, even though I knew some people, you know, and had good friends, but it still wasn't something that I really wanted to, kind of face head on. Meg's sister had become, quite the activist. And we kind of knew that. And so at some point, you know, we're doing the carpet cleaning. I'm boiling water and I'm dumping it in the machine. And then I'm carrying like the heavy water up the stairs, and Meg keeps at it. And then I go clean it out and keep boiling water. We have this system that's going really perfectly. And we're doing our whole house and we're trying to get ready for a move. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it just like stops. And now I have, you know, I have all this water, it's all ready to go, and it's just like dead quiet up there. And I'm just like, what is going on? Come on, people, you know, we've got a time limit here. And so finally I go upstairs and I'm just like, hey guys, what's going on? But I could see in the room right when we walked in, it was just completely somber and quiet. And John was kind of staring off like at the wall, apart from me. Mm-hmm. And Meg was just kind of sitting on the bed. And I was just like, oh my God, I mean, what's, you know, I was in my head, I thought somebody had died, but I was like, okay, neither, you two are both living. So that's
how
good.
How bad can it be?
Yeah. And so they started to interact a little bit, and Meg said, Jake, John has something that he wants to tell you. And she said, she was asking John, should I tell him, you know, and he just kind of like nodded his head. And so, Meg looked over at me and she said, well, John, just inform me that he's gay. You know, just like that. And she said it really with like really confidently, like no tears or anything like that. And so it was interesting because I'm sitting there, so I'm processing that immediately. And she continues to have a little conversation with John about how much he wants to get involved in this conversation. And John is just facing the wall. And as she's talking to John, she keeps looking over at me, you know, where John can't see, and just like trying to hide the tears from John, but show them to me. I don't know what do we do? You know, this is all. So we're trying to communicate while they're trying to communicate all in this moment that is going to be this epic moment in our life, probably, you know, that we'll go back and remember. And we're all trying to do it the right way. You know, I'm processing everything, because for me it was, to say I was shocked is probably the right word. To surprised, no, because you know, we knew John his whole life, and there was, you know, like she mentioned, I mean, he was effeminate. There was a couple little things. He definitely fell under a lot of the stereotypes, but not so much that it was super obvious. Mm-hmm. So and it seemed that in the prior year it had become less obvious than the whole previous 12 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was saying. I was more shocked, but still not surprised. And then if you want to tell him what I said, I don't ever remember. I don't even remember this.
I know, he doesn't remember.
My analogy.
So John likes to say that when he looked over at his dad, he had his thinking face on. So he looked like he was thinking, and
I had my thinking face
on. You had your thinking face on, and you were just really contemplative. But Jake said, the first words out of his mouth were, "You know, John, I don't like tomatoes." He said, I can't eat tomatoes.
Well, we should preface this really, really quickly with, I literally, since I was a kid, I've never been able to eat tomatoes. And at age about 20 or 21, I decided I was going to eat a tomato every year. Like, have a bite of a tomato and just try to eat it. And until eventually I got used to it. And so so that's what I did from about 21 till 30.
Because eating tomatoes is normal. You should be able to eat tomatoes.
Everybody eats tomatoes. But literally for every year, I would eat a tomato and I would spit it out. I could not swallow it. Mm-hmm. So John, it was the same way. I mean, but at a younger age, you know, he couldn't stand tomatoes, which is common, you know, for obviously kids are developing their taste buds. But he joined me in that, and he was, "I'll eat one every year too," mm-hmm. you know, with me. And he would spit it out. So there's a little back.
That's the history of it. But he said, you know, "I don't like tomatoes, and that's okay." And he said, "And John, you're gay, and that's okay. And I love you." And so that was what Jake said.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, my twisted mind, I'm thinking, what's normal? Yeah, normal people like tomatoes.
I can't change that. I don't like tomatoes.
People make fun of me for it.
I've tried.
So that was my really kind of pathetic analogy in that moment.
Now here I am thinking.
So now I understand what it's like to be gay.
That's what
I'm getting at.
But I thought that was pretty good. I was just like sobbing, and "I love you," and Jake just kept it together. Yeah. So we all talked that night, and I remember John just being like, "Mom, I don't want you to be sad." Like, we were both so, it was just this really kind of heavy situation. I think he didn't expect that. So he just stepped outside. He went outside to take a deep breath, and I was just like stunned. And Jake and I were just like, what are you? Like,
yeah, we didn't talk to him much that night.
I was like, what do we
after
do?
That.
I did.
I mean, us together.
Yeah.
We talked to each other mostly.
So all of a sudden I just thought, oh my gosh, did he just like run away? And I went sprinting downstairs, and I went outside, and he just was pacing on the sidewalk. And I was like, "John, am I doing this wrong? What can I do? I'm sorry. And what did you expect? What did you expect from me? And I'll be that. I'll try. You know, I want you to know that I love you." We just hugged again, and he's like, "Mom, I'm so sorry. I don't want you to be sad." He's like, maybe I could make it work. Maybe I could be bisexual. And maybe there's just this one person out there that even gay men, this one woman, and I'll find her and I'll try." And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about this. But whatever you choose, John, we'll support you." And so, I didn't tell him right away that, like, I was just kind of that almost gave me a little bit of hope, if you will, that, okay, he can still have that vision. But then I started just thinking, I don't know. So we put him to bed that night. I tucked him in, told him we loved him for the millionth time. And he went to bed. And that's when we both just broke down. We were just both so sad. So I don't know what Jake was doing, but I needed a moment by myself. And so I'm in my closet, and the irony of that is but I wanted a quiet space where John couldn't hear me cry. So I was in my closet, and I was crying because I was just sad. Some people call it like mourning the loss of the future you had for your child, but that's the only thing I can kind of relate it to. And I was just crying, and I was in this desperate situation, and all I knew to do as a Mormon girl was pray. And I had never prayed like this. I have never felt this desperate for comfort and to know everything was going to be okay in that moment. And so I audibly cried out, "Who could deny such a soul as this?" And it was the most spiritual experience of my entire life. It started at my head, and it just poured through me, and it went all the way to my fingertips and to my toes, and I remember it to this day. And I heard the words, "Not I." And I felt like I knew the purpose of our gay brothers and sisters and how special they were. I don't know how, it just flooded into me that they are special and that this is a gift, and that Heavenly Father was aware of John and that he loved him exactly the way he was, and that he was created this way for a purpose. And interestingly enough, John told me that he felt that he was made this way for a purpose, that Heavenly Father, he knew Heavenly Father loved him and that he was totally okay with this, and that this is okay with him. So here I am having this amazing spiritual experience. Some people like to think of it as the spirit within or the divine, and my head was kind of getting in the way, but all of a sudden my heart just screamed louder that this is your son. And because I was kind of like, I don't know this boy, this is a gay boy, do I? But then it said he was gay yesterday, he was gay when he came to you, you've always known this gay boy. And so all of a sudden I just felt like this loud screaming in my mind, call Anessa. My sister Anessa, who Jake had mentioned, is a LGBT ally, and I didn't know what that meant. What's an ally? So I call her up and I just started crying again. I didn't know if I could spit the words out. And Anessa was like, I'm just sobbing. And she's like, oh my gosh, did somebody die? Because I couldn't get the words out. And I said, no. And so she just got quiet and she just kind of just waited. And I said, John's gay. And she said, Meg, I can help you. And within, she talked to me, she said, I've learned so much, Meg, there's so much misunderstanding. I can help you. I know so many things. And I was like, okay. And she said, I have reading material. Do you want me to send you? And I said, yes, anything, just send me everything. And she started with, MormonsandGays.org, the official church, stance. And then she said, and read through this. And when you're done with this, then start here. And she, sent me to the affirmation page, affirmation.org. And then, she said, okay. And when you're done with that, read this. And so she said, go slow, take your time, read through everything and call me if you have any questions and we can talk about this. But she said, I think John is perfect just the way he is. And I have to say, I think I saw this coming. And so she had been preparing herself for like a year for this. And anyway, so I started reading. I didn't sleep all night long. I read and read and read. And the more I read, the more I understood. And I think knowledge is power. And I just didn't know. And so I woke John up the next morning for church. And I said, John, I have some really good news for you. And he was like, what? And I said, you're gay. And that's okay. And you don't have to try to be bisexual for me. I accept you and love you just how you are. And he says, I know. He knew.
Yeah.
So then we go to the bishop that day because we were like,
right,
we need ecclesiastical direction. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, I'll go back. And so after the night that John came out to us and told us, and after we put him to bed and we kind of went our separate ways, Meg went into the closet. I never went into the closet. I started out of the closet.
That didn't dawn on me at the time.
But I didn't really have anybody to call or reach out to. You know, we didn't have each other because neither one of us knew what was going on. I mean, it wasn't, we weren't going to be able to help each other other than just kind of comfort each other. And so when he told us, I remember looking at him, or when Meg told me through him, and he was kind of staring at the wall, I remember just kind of looking at him, probably after I said the tomato thing, and just thinking he looked different, like really different. You know, he was like a different person to me, you know, and not bad, better, anything, just different. And Meg mentioned already, you know, you felt like you're mourning the loss of somebody. But I think what I've realized now is you're mourning the loss of the future that you had anticipated, you know, what you've prepared for, you know. And had we been more open, I think when we were younger, to realize that there were multiple routes that, mm-hmm. To sexuality, you know, it might not have been that way, because we could have been more open or prepared for it. Because, mm-hmm. like I said, it didn't surprise me that he was gay. So if I had done a little research when I was younger, or when he was younger, then that whole process probably would have been a lot smoother, a lot different. So, but I remember feeling like I'm mourning the death of a child, but I'm getting a new one, you know, but I didn't know that new one yet. And so that wasn't as exciting for me because that was a new person. But I was just sad about the death of the old one. But I also immediately felt guilty for feeling that way, you know, for feeling like, well, why am I, who am I, you know, I was like, how awful is that of me to act like, okay, my straight kid's dead and now I have a gay one? That seems really awful to think that. And I was feeling guilty about that. And so that was my biggest dilemma, I guess. And so while she was in the closet, I actually drove, we didn't have great cell service in our house. And so I drove across the street and I had a tennis buddy of mine that we play tennis together a lot. And he's a pastor for a Baptist church. And we had had long, long conversations about similars and differences between the Baptist church and the Mormon church. And we've really, and at the end of each one of these discussions, we were both felt edified. They were really positive learning experiences that we were trying to help each other understand one another. Very civil conversation, because I know the whole Baptists, Mormons aren't supposed to be able to be in the same room. So, but he and I were really, really good friends and a great guy, one of the best people I know. And so I drove across the street and I called him, of all people. And I don't know why I called him first, but I called him and I told him, you know, and I was emotional, trying to process everything. And because I had to actually say the words, you know, to somebody else. And that was my own little version of coming out, you know, because I was admitting it to somebody else, like it was a problem, you know, which is back then, I looked at it a little bit differently. So I told him about it, and then I just told him, I said, and I feel the worst part about it is it was the way that I feel. I feel awful that I feel like I feel guilty for feeling like he's dead, you know, and there's a new one there, you know, and I felt awful about that. And he said, this guy's young. I think he was probably 33, 34, and I don't know a lot about the Baptist seminaries or their education, but he had been doing I don't know whatever his education is. I guess it would be the equivalent of like a thesis or a doctorate in mainstream education on basically helping Christians come to terms with like homosexuality, in their lives and kind of meshing the two. He'd been doing this for the last 10 to 12 years, and I had no idea. We'd actually never talked about this prior to that. And so when I told him, he goes, "You have no idea." He said, you called the right person. And so here I am talking to my Baptist buddy with my Mormon kids telling me he's gay. So that was the first person I called. But he told me, he said that he has sat there and counseled probably 30 couples in his tenure. And he said, without exception, every single couple have felt the same way that I did, you know, and he said every single one of them has felt like they've had to go through a mourning process, like they've lost somebody, you know, but then over time, you know, you realize that you get somebody as well. And then you realize it's the same somebody. So, yeah, he'd mentioned, my pastor friend, he'd mentioned how it was really, really, really common for a lot of parents to have those similar feelings. And it was really just what I needed to hear, because I was feeling bad just about myself, that I was handling it the wrong way, and that John would look back on this, you know, or that I would look back on it as like I was this horrible person who, you know, couldn't accept him for how he was. And this is how I internalized it. But there's some sense of, by feeling like I was normal, you know, that felt better at some level. But then I haven't really talked to him again about it. We talked for about 45 minutes to an hour, and he's kind of followed up with me a little bit since then. But I kind of feel like I got what I needed from the Baptists. But, you know, but it was really helpful at the time.
As I was forming, well, to start out, this will be relevant. As I was forming my thoughts about what life's going to look like for John an out gay teenager. I'm on the phone with my sister and I'm just kind of like talking all this through, and all of a sudden just this powerful protection comes over me. I've always been a mama bear. But in that moment I told Anessa, I said, I'm not a mama bear. Isn't tough enough. I was like, I need to be like a dragon, and I need to have scales and talons and claws, and I need to breathe fire. And I'm just all of a sudden thinking, if anybody were to hurt him, it just, so that in that moment is when I kind of started telling her about that. And I started feeling very protective. I even felt like I needed to protect John from Jake, because I, at this point, didn't know where he was at with it. We hadn't discussed it. We were just kind of both like kind of processing in our own terms. And then I felt like I had to protect him from Jake. I felt like I had to protect him from the church. I felt like I had to protect him from anything that could hurt him or anybody. And just because in that moment, that's what I was going through. And I understand children get hurt and they fall down and they get their feelings hurt and they, you know, get their hearts broken. But I just started feeling very overprotective. So we go to our bishop the next day. It was Sunday. And, I was just sitting in the pew and just looking around and thinking, I wonder who else, what other youth here is gay? And I wonder how they're being treated. I wonder if their parents know. I wonder if they know, or if they're struggling at all. Because of everything I had read that night, I started to read about the plight of LDS youth who are gay. And I just started getting really nervous. So I wanted to meet with the bishop right away. And so to kind of start that process, and I told him that John was gay and that he knows it, and we know it, and we're fine with this. And I was kind of going to be like, okay, so where's the group of moms and dads? Where can we go and kind of have a support group and meet other people like us? And he didn't have anything. He had nothing for us. And I was disappointed. You know, his heart generally felt sad for us. And then all of a sudden I was getting annoyed that he was feeling sad. Cause like, is there something wrong with John? And so I instantly like started getting, oh great, now I have to protect my son from the bishop, even though he was like so kind and so nice. I started just kind of like, John wasn't there, but I just started kind of like gathering him in my little mama dragon wings. Like, wait, you too? So everybody, it was like, he's a minor. Everybody got filtered through, and I was very careful who I didn't want ideology to get in the way of him loving himself. I really liked where he was at that moment. I liked that he felt peace, and I didn't want that to be disrupted, if that makes sense. But we had a really great bishop. He was really kind. Mm-hmm. He didn't really have anything for us. He gave us a little pamphlet, which I gave to John, and John felt that wasn't very helpful. So I didn't have anything. We didn't have anything to kind of look for and look. So that's.
Yeah. And I talked to our bishop several times after that, and he is a little bit more socially liberal than probably your average, Mormon bishop. But he's also very, I guess he would also fall under the lines of like obedient as well.
Yeah.
And so he followed the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. But some of our conversations offline were encouraging to me. Mm-hmm. But in our conversations, it felt like he was walking away with more, you know, than I was. I felt like I was just educating him on the things I learned. And this is over the next couple of months, you know, which is when we initially were going to him for the council, you know, it was new to him. He hadn't, it was brand new.
Now I have to deal with it.
So that Sunday, which was, he told us on a Thursday night.
Friday. No, Saturday. Because then we woke up and went to church.
No, because it was.
Did we like say
we'll go back and look? But I'm pretty sure.
I think it was a Thursday. You're right.
Because on Friday was the, and I'll get this right. Friday was the Supreme Court. What was the deal? Everybody had red equal signs all over their Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. They were taking Donna to the Supreme Court. They hadn't made a ruling yet.
Right. Anyway, the.
That's right.
So he came out, and the next day we immediately saw on Facebook mm-hmm. who allies were, mm-hmm. you know, or who were going to be of our friends, because people were changing their statuses to their, or their pictures to their red equal sign.
Very accommodating.
Yeah, it was very, very. And we were just like, just mental note check, you know,
okay,
you know. And then some people who would make comments very, very derogatory against, we were like, okay, mental note check.
Okay, you're
and
not
so,
safe.
Yeah, the timing of that was really, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so over that weekend, I'd had a thought, because I'd been praying too and really trying to understand and internalize, like, what does this mean? We were reading scriptures in the Bible together and all, mm-hmm. I mean, all kinds of stuff that we didn't, I mean, mm-hmm. I can't remember the last time we'd ever read the Bible together, actually.
Like, poured over it.
Like, you know,
yeah.
and like studying some of Christ's words.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a thought going back to in the Book of Mormon with Alma, for Alma the Younger. I mean, Alma, the quick backstory is Alma, Alma was a, we'll just call him a religious leader in the land, and his son was basically disobedient. I like to look at him as he probably was out egging houses and all causing all kinds of vandalism. But for him, it was all in the name of the church. I mean, he fought his dad against he fought the church, you know, because he probably had issues with his father. But so anyway, long story short is he's out and he's essentially visited by an angel, told that he needs to stop doing this, rendered unconscious for a couple of days. And during this time, he's converted to the gospel. He has a vision or whatnot, and he's converted to the gospel. Essentially, wakes up the next day and he's out off and running, preaching the gospel. And he kind of led the way for everybody else who went in and ended up teaching the Lamanites and bringing the gospel to those who were considered outcasts, I guess. But my thought on it was, he's an undeserving prophet. I mean, he did nothing. He literally did nothing for his testimony. He did nothing for that change. I would assume that his father and other people were praying for him and that kind of thing. But Alma the Younger, by himself, he didn't do anything. He wasn't trying to change. And there's people that their whole lives, they struggle and they pray and they fast trying to change, and they try to have a testimony or just trying to believe in God or anything, you know, and they go their whole life wanting that and don't quite get it the way that he was just given it. And so, but granted, he was given it, and then he went off and did great things with that. So, so then a couple of days after that, Tuesday night, John came and told me that he had a project that was due, or a portion of a project that was due in one of his classes. He's a life skills class where they were actually making pillowcases in class, and he was supposed to show up with three pieces of material, different colors, for his pillowcase. And so it's 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and the only place that opens is Walmart. And so we get in the car, we go to Walmart. And
I wasn't there.
Yeah, no, Meg wasn't there.
I was asleep.
Yeah, Meg was in bed really early. But so we get in the car and we go, and this might have been one of the first times that John and I really got to be together, just he and I, mm-hmm. going to do something, since he told us it had only been about 4 days. And so
Jake had proven to me that he could be trusted.
Right. I was allowed to take our son out in public. So we go to Walmart, and we're walking around Walmart and looking at fabric, and it kind of dawned on me, you know, the stereotype. I'm okay, 4 days after my son tells me he's gay, I'm out picking fabric. You know, we're picking fabric out together. And we had a little bit of a laugh about it.
Cool, this is fast.
Mm-hmm. it was totally comfortable. But so we picked out we picked out three fabrics that he liked, three different colors and patterns. And we brought them up, and we were trying to find somebody to cut them. And of course, it's now 10:30. And so we finally find a gentleman. There's this African American, really, really young guy. He looked like he might have been 18, 19. And I kind of got his attention. He came over to cut the fabric that we needed. And it was really apparent, you know, every stereotype out there, you know, this Walmart associate, and he fell under every one of the stereotypes. I mean, there's no way in my mind, in my judgment, that he wasn't gay. I mean, this guy was definitely gay, you know. And I kind of looked down to John, and I kind of motioned him, and I said, you know, and he's like, really, you know, and John didn't have any gaydar at that point. So, And I was even thinking, I was like, wait, is it appropriate for me to even say that he's gay or that I think he's gay? You know, because this is all new and I didn't know what was appropriate or what was offensive. But and so anyway, he starts to cut our fabric, and I'm watching him cut our fabric, and I'm kind of looking at this guy, and he's behind a counter, and suddenly I realized I had this incredible urge to basically walk around the counter. I wanted to put my arm around him. I wanted to bring him back for dinner. I wanted to get to know this guy. Didn't know anything about him, you know, but just because of this label that I just put on him, that I thought he was gay, I wanted to welcome him into our house. And at that point, I realized that I'd been given like a gift, you know, that like literally almost like overnight, you know, to nothing I had done, I've been given this kind of gift, if you will, to accept people in the LGBT community. I mean, just like that, you know. And I hadn't, because for my whole entire 40 years of life, I saw LGBT people a little bit. That it was like, yeah, there's something that, you know, okay, I'm sure they're people, that's fine, but it was something that was unsettling. I didn't want to overly engage. So I always had a little bit of a guard up, and now I just flipped, and what was the opposite? I literally wanted to climb up the counter and welcome this guy, mm-hmm. and that's when I realized I was like Alma, you know, I was like Alma, where I'd been given this thing, I'd basically been given this gift. I didn't deserve it. I hadn't done anything, you know, to have this change of heart, and I had this just incredible amount of love for a group of people that I had always felt uncomfortable around. You know, and it was, you know, and I was like grateful. And then, so to me, like in my own mind, you know, I was like, I'm so glad, for selfish reasons, I'm so glad that John's gay, because he's taught me, you know, he's taught me how to love in a way that I thought I had always loved before. But at that moment, I realized that I hadn't. And I told some people this later that, I was like, yeah, I wouldn't, if I could make him straight, I wouldn't, you know. And other people are like, really, you know, why would you wish that hard life on him? And I was like, no, because it's changed who I am, you know, and there's no way that I could ever, I don't know if I would have ever become like this if it hadn't have been for that. And when I see other allies out there who are so loving towards the LGBT community, who aren't directly affected like we are, I have that much more respect for them, you know, and because they came to it on their own, through their own method and in their own mind. But yeah, I owe all that to John. So
mm-hmm. It's always surprising to me that when I would share my personal experience that I had in that closet, and kind of what I say was like my lowest moment, where I needed some assurance of him, of his standing, I guess, with God and his eternal salvation, and questions that weren't answered, that aren't answered. We don't have these answers. And when I share that with people, I'm always surprised that they're not having this, they aren't having the same experience that I am. So I just feel like I have a lot of work to do to gather more allies, and just to help people come to a place of love and acceptance. And I just feel like Jake, it was just kind of a gift. It was given to me. And
yeah, people ask us all the time. That is the number one question that probably LGBT youth ask, or even adults.
No, adults. Like,
they ask us, like, what is it? What did you do, or what did John do, or what was different, you know, that made you accept John? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's not an answer.
Okay.
Like, we didn't do anything. I felt we both feel like we were just, here you go, here's a big plate of acceptance, you know, and we just kind of ate it up, and we were just fortunate.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so many other parents that I know, or I should say children of other parents, have quite different experiences. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just glad that John. I mean, that I feel really thankful, yeah, that we were able to luckily just kind of be that way for John's sake.
Here's how I kind of like say it. If you want something to say to your parents, or if you want something to say to a friend, and you really do kind of have to unlearn everything you already know. But initially, I feel like we all have a piece of divinity within us. We all have this, in our church we say the light of Christ, and it's just pure love. And what is the greatest commandment is love. So I understand that your mind and what you've learned and everything in your head can get in the way. But somehow, this divine within me was able to emerge, was able to come out louder than my mind. So what I would say to people is to just learn about it, read. There's so much to know. There are noble things out there. There's so much to learn and know, and then like just let your mind go and let your heart lead you. Let your follow. That's really all it comes down to. It's follow Christ's example of love one another.
For the first 3 or 4 months, I probably was unlearning more or as much as I was learning.
Yeah.
And then after, now I'm more learning, but there's so much unlearning that needs to be done, especially for coming from, a Christian background, and being politically to the right and everything else that you've kind of been told. A lot of it's just not true.
So a couple of months after John came out, I had heard about, we got in contact with Randall Thacker. He's the president of Affirmation. Was instantly in contact with all these people. Daniel Parkinson, Randall Thacker, Bryce Cook, just a lot of, John DeLand, Carolyn Pearson, a lot of people were reaching out to me. And which was, I was so grateful for, but Randall Thacker had mentioned that there was a DC Pride Parade coming up. In my mind, I was like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go march with Mormons for equality.
And we're not going to tell my husband.
I kind of just tricked Jake into the car. He didn't really know what was going on, but I was worried he would be leery of marching in a pride parade. But I just felt like this is what I need to do. I was on fire. I was lit up, and I was telling John, like, grab your rainbow bow tie. We're going to go march in the DC Pride Parade. Jake, bring some church clothes because you dress in church. But it was a superhero theme, the parade. And so I had Jake wear a Superman shirt underneath because I call Jake Super. It's kind of like my term of endearment for him. He's super because he's Superman. He's just... You are. Anyway, so I got him a Superman shirt, and he wore a white shirt underneath it with his tie going like this way. So here's Jake, kind of like, I don't know what Pride Parade really is. I'm just gonna go. I could tell he was like, I don't know if I'm here yet, and I just ignored it. I was like, we're gonna march as a family. We're gonna all hold hands, and we're gonna march, and we're gonna hold our signs. And so we get there, and there's a big banner, Mormons for Equality, just showing that though the church doesn't support marriage equality at this time, that there are people within the church that do. And I was definitely one of those people. The more I learned, the more I wanted John to have love and companionship in a marriage. And I believe that is what God would want him to do. So we're marching, so we get to DC Pride, and Jake's just kind of like a ghost. Like, I mean, there's the most amazing colorful people all around, and just in these bright headdresses and everything. It was just so exciting for me. It was a feast for the eyes. It's something I'd never experienced before, and I just remember feeling so much love and thinking, do you all know how special you are? Because to me, the LGBT community is special. It's more special than I am. I'm just regular. I don't know. Not regular, but anyway. So to me, I was just like, I had wide eyes. I was really excited.
Meg talks about all the colors. I just talk about the big platform of 80 Abercrombie & Fitch models and like in their little skinny underwear. They're dancing.
They look good.
No, I know.
Those guys look good. But Jake was just like,
It was definitely a culture shock for me. But we're over there, this little group of Mormons. They end up to be
in Sunday dress.
Like 50 or 60 of us, maybe.
62.
But we're over there, in the staging area where we have colorful people behind us, Abercrombie models in front of us.
Oh, we had drag queens in the most beautiful dresses, and
one of the Abercrombie models comes over. They're not really Abercrombie, but he comes over, you know, wearing almost nothing, you know, and comes over. He's like, "Hey, I'm Mormon," you know, and do you remember this guy?
Yes, I do. I said, and I gave him the biggest hug, and I was like, "Oh, me too."
Yeah, and he was so excited that we were there.
He got teary-eyed.
Yeah,
he got really choked up. It was emotional for him. He was really appreciative that we were there.
I guarantee that when he woke up that morning, knowing that he was going to the parade and, you know, put his underwear on and that's it, never thought he'd see a bunch of Mormons or have a conversation with Mormons. And so it was really kind of, it was neat to kind of be there and just have this little tiny impact on this individual. Of a, you know, to represent a group of people who have been kind of perceived as the enemy, for so long, and so you know, you could see there was like this little hope, this little like, oh wow, you know, there's only 50 of you, but wow, you know, you guys are here, this is awesome.
So we had these stickers that said hugged. Mm-hmm. It says hugged by a Mormon, and I was hugged by a Mormon, and so I said, "Well, I've hugged you. Do you want a sticker?" And he was like, "Sure." I mean, so muscular. I mean, just like bulging muscles everywhere. And I just kind of took my, so I was like, "Okay, there you go. Okay." I just thought he was so nice. And it's just so genuine. And you could just tell he had this the sweetest spirit. Just a good soul. Mm-hmm. Too many S's. He had a lovely soul. You could just see it in his eyes. So then somebody hands you what? You get handed a sign, Mormons for Marriage Equality.
Oh, yeah.
And Jake's like, "Well, I guess I'm for this now."
Yeah. Well, I didn't know why we were there. I was like, "Oh, okay, this is why we're here. All right."
Okay. You know what? I feel like I was being just a little deceptive.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
But it all worked out.
No, it's fine.
It works out. John knew. Yeah, John I knew what was going on.
I would have come.
You would have come.
But
regardless.
I just didn't know. It's funny.
But I didn't know if you wouldn't.
Yeah.
So Jake's marching. Of course, he's a huge hit. Everybody was loving Jake. So I had my sign. It had rainbows on it. It was an equal sign. And then on the back it says, Jesus. What did it say? Jesus gave his love. Carolyn Pearson song, I'll Walk With You. I quoted from it because it's been my favorite song my whole since it came out in the 80s. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting. Anyway, so I was just in my rainbow dress and rainbow sign, and we were walking. But Jake was a hugging machine. So
that was my job.
Tell him what happened to you.
Oh, well, I was, so our job is to hug people, and Edward Jones and I were kind of the...
Edward Jones was
the huggers.
He went crazy.
And so we were running along the side. You know, we're walking at a parade marching pace, you know, pretty slow. And he and I had just this huge pamphlet of stickers, and they were going around. And you know, every time someone's giving you a high five, you know, we're like, "Hey, we don't give high five. You know, we give hugs." And so we would give hugs and we'd give out stickers and. You know, and I didn't, you know, anybody that was right there, anybody that seemed engaging or anybody that seemed kind of not engaging, you know, those are the two people I would kind of target. And I was like, "I'm going to hug whoever." But what happened, though, what surprised me is time and time again, this probably happened 10 or 15 times during this 2 mile walk, is I would run into somebody and I would give them a hug and they would hold me for a couple extra seconds. And so it might be like a 4 second hug, which is an eternity when you're walking in a parade. And so, but in this small segment of time, this one individual in particular, he was able to relay this information to me. He, you know, that he was Mormon. He was returned missionary. He was gay, you know, and that us being there, was saving his life. I mean, it was just, he said, "You have no idea what kind of hope this gives for me." So he said that us being there was literally, it was like saving his life, and that it gave him so much hope that, you know, that if we could change, you know, we could accept him for who he was, that he could accept him for who he was, because he was raised Mormon, you know. And it literally, I mean, we'd had this like really, really quick conversation, really in a matter of seconds, and we kind of pulled apart, you know, and he was just, I mean, just waterfalls, just tears coming down. And, you know, of course, they gave him a sticker You know, but then we're off, you know, and now I'm 30 feet behind my group. And so I have to like run up but that kept happening over and over and over. I mean, every single time I would stop, you know, about every 10 people I hugged, there was like a moment where somebody, the fact that the Mormons were there supporting them, it just made all the difference in the world. And people were shocked that we were there and just so grateful. And the biggest thing is it was hopeful. Mm-hmm. You know, because here we were the perceived enemy out there, and we were coming in there and saying, no, this isn't, you know, not everybody went door to door Prop 8. Not everybody thinks the way that you probably think that they do. Mm-hmm. And so here we are doing what we can. And there was a small group comparatively to obviously the size of the church in the DC area, but we represented it, you know, where we could. Yeah. And I tell people all the time, like that 2 mile walk, I mean, that's probably the single thing that changed my life probably more than anything.
Yeah.
So, or changed the way I looked at life.
Yeah, hands down, one of the most spiritual mm-hmm. experiences I've ever had. Just of pure love. It was like a very concentrated dose of love. And so, I think that's just sad that some people are keeping themselves from just loving and recognizing gifts and special qualities of people and our differences, and something that I was guilty of before. But thankfully I've had this experience, and I always feel so bad when people don't have a gay child, because I feel bad for them, because it's such a gift. It's the greatest gift of my life. And I thought just having a baby, I thought I would never have a baby, and I thought that was such a gift. And I feel like I've tried to never take that for granted, that I get to have a child, because I know that that is a gift, and not everybody has. So I always wanted to just do the best I could as a mom and not take that for granted. And so now I feel like everybody's capable of this. You don't just need a gay child, you just need a heart, a good heart, and to be loving. And some people will feel like they're being loving to you in the Mormon community. There's always a but. If we can get rid of the "I love you, but," that would be amazing. If it just ended there, "I love you," and that's where it ends.
Well, what I always look at it, I mean, we've had a lot of conversations with members of the church who are probably trying to understand. Some of them are probably trying to understand. Some of them are probably trying to help us understand. you know, but when I talk to somebody, it's very, very simple to determine if this is going to be somebody that is worth talking to. Is whether or not they're asking questions of us to try to learn what we've learned, or else if they're just trying to tell us stuff, to tell us what they know, you know.
Yeah.
Because I've had 40 years of knowing what you know. You know, I mean, I've seen it through that lens, you know, almost my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, and having been there and then been here, this is so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So much better.
Feels good.
You know, and I know you couldn't have talked me into this. You know, you couldn't have... There's nothing that you could have said to make me convert, you know. We kind of had to go through it. And like Meg said, I mean, we're so thankful. We owe it to John. And John's courage to just even say something. Because, I mean, most kids are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever, before they ever say something. We would have missed out.
Yeah.
So.
There's a lot of people in John's life, too, that we owe... John's life, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things. We're just really lucky that he instantly accepted himself, and that's just.
Yeah, we learned really quickly how rare that was at that age, especially in the Mormon faith or any Christian kind of background.
Yeah.
How there's not, I mean, being gay, or I should say, realizing that you're gay, and being of some kind of Christian denomination. They don't go together very well, and most of these kids, I mean, they suffer.
That was
they suffer. They feel like God Himself hates them, and John never had any of that. So that's been our goal the whole this ever since that. That's always been the number one priority, is to make sure that he doesn't ever get any of that, because mm-hmm. it's such a unique part about him.
Yeah, that was one of the first things John told me about when he was coming out to me that first night, is that he had heard about children killing themselves as early as 12 years old. Because they're gay and they feel like there's no hope. And I was stunned, and I started doing my own research, and then it just everything I learned, it was just more and more sickening. And I thought, we have to do something. We have to change this. We can't lose one more of these beautiful, precious souls. What I think is the most precious soul. We need our LGBT brothers and sisters. We need everybody here. We can't lose anymore. We can't lose anymore. And so that was really why John wanted to be vocal. He told me his exact words were, I want to be a beacon of hope to know, for other kids out there, other people, gay boys out there, girls or transgender, anything that is out of the societal norm, that you can be happy, and you're okay. You're perfect just how you are, and that you were made this way. And
yeah, when he said, this is back when he was telling Meg, you know, hey, there's this thing called the closet, mm-hmm. you know, and he thought he was educating, which just goes to show how innocent he really was about everything. You tell me he's choosing to be gay. He didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I'm gay. I know it. I know God knows it. I know he made me this way. And that's when he said he wants to be out. And, you know, and that scared us.
Yeah.
Badly, because we're like, okay, you're 13, yeah. We'll help you do this, but we'll do it as a family, we'll do it kind of on our terms too a little bit, because we know we felt like we had to protect him mm-hmm. from the unknown a little bit. But we realized really, really quickly he was going to have none of that, because his motivation for coming out was to be out so that other kid who sat in the classroom across from him mm-hmm. who was also gay felt like he had somebody else that was like him, somebody else that he could kind of lean on. And that's why John said, he goes, I want to be a beacon of hope and light mm-hmm. for those, you know, those who don't have any. And that just, in the time, I mean, I don't think, I didn't realize like how powerful that was, you know, mm-hmm. or how mature that was. But that was his motivation, was not for him. It was for other kids that were probably in his school.
I think some of the most selfless people I have ever met are gay or fall under the LGBT category for sure. So that's just a selfless part of him. And interestingly enough, once he did come out at school, there's this domino effect. Like everybody comes out, everybody that as LGBT, they're all out at school. And since we've left,
they felt,
it's just kind of this steamroll effect, and they're all felt like it gave everybody courage to be their own. So John accomplished what he set out to do.
We began to research options for John for the future of what it would be like to be gay, be a Mormon, and to and for the future options that you had. As we with the church, and the church, basically the doctrines of the church are very clear, and they teach that you know, while people don't choose to be gay, you know, obviously choosing what lifestyle they choose or what lifestyle they go is their choice. But that leaves very little options for somebody. I mean, that leaves a life of celibacy. And to me, that when you talk, people talk about celibacy, that suggestion that being gay is only about sex, which is not. You know, it's not just being celibate. The end result of being celibate is also being alone. And that's not, I mean, nobody, that's not for anybody, in my opinion. And so that leaves John's future of being alone, or it leaves him in a mixed orientation situation where he would be with a woman, somebody that he'd be limited, I would say, in how much he could love. But I think even the church, they don't even encourage those kinds of relationships anymore. Mm-hmm. And then of course the other option is to being with someone of his same sex. And whatever he decides to do, I mean, we'll support him because ultimately it's about his happiness. And as long as he holds tight to the foundation and the morals, them and they apply across the board. I mean, whether you're gay, straight, or anything, those morals are still ingrained in us, and we want to pass those on because the principles that the Mormon Church teaches are sound. They're sound principles. I mean, the family structure, I understand why they support the family structure, but I also can see another family structure that may be out of the norm a little bit, but equally, it can be equally supported. Yeah. So as we did research on a lot of this, we came across the Family Acceptance Project, mm-hmm. and Meg did a lot more research into that and got involved really quickly. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
It does kind of shed a light on the plight of a gay teenager. And the percentages that I was reading, which I recommend to everybody to read the Family Acceptance Project, but the threat when children aren't accepted is the threat of drug addiction, suicide, promiscuity, all of these things when you're kind of bottling something up and not being accepted for who you really are, which is intrinsic and is in your orientation. My orientation is intrinsic in me. And so I got in contact with a really good group of people, and I just got more information. And so I felt like I was armed and ready to protect him. Another thing that it kind of warned against was homelessness in our LGBT youth community, and that we have the suicide rates right now are with LGBT kids or with teenagers in general are at epidemic levels, and for some reason that doesn't sink into people like it did me, that I thought that was the deal breaker. Here, I felt like I was saving my child's life. I'm giving him the best chance at happiness and a wonderful future. And just by loving and accepting him. But for some reason, that wasn't, that doesn't fall into the cultural norm of our church. So I would reference, if I could, the 11th Article of Faith, which kind of gave me permission to follow my heart. And that I was taught personal revelation. Our church is founded on personal revelation. So I felt entitled to my own personal revelation about my family and my child. And the 11th Article of Faith says, we claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience, and allow all men the same privilege. Let them worship how, where, or what they may. So I started putting that into the context of how I can view this, and with my own conscience and with my own heart and with revelation, that personal revelation that I feel that it was very strong and very direct to me, and just know that I'm doing the right thing. And yes, I think some of my ideals ideologically go against the church, but most of it does. I want him to be chaste, and I want him to be respectful, and all of the things that I would required him before, I still require of him. And I want him to get married. I want him to be fidelity with his spouse, and I want all these things, the same things for him. I just know that it's most likely will be with someone of his same gender.
Right. And right now there really is no revealed doctrine on LGBT people. I mean, it's the only thing that we know is what, because they don't fit into the mold that the church has set forth. Mm-hmm. This is how you gain salvation. You do this. Well, if you're LGBT, it's a little bit different because that's a different path for you. It's more of what you can't do. And not about what you can do. And so I think what Meg's saying too is, you know, we're entitled to some kind of personal revelation here to help guide our son towards his own salvation, you know, and help lead him the right way and give him some principles for him to follow. for when there may or may not be other doctrines revealed. I mean, who knows what the future will be? But it's hard to lead somebody down a path of a bunch of cannots, you know, because that's just a path that doesn't exist. And so we love the Mormon Church and the foundations and the teachings and the moral guide that it offers. And we would hope that John would follow those same moral principles, no matter what he decides to do with his life or who he decides to be with.
So, yes, basically what I would suggest is for people to, like I said, listen to your own heart, which is, you know, get your own personal revelation about this and accept and embrace your child and see what a blessing it is and that they are a treasure that should be treasured. They are, and when I hear about another child being neglected or kicked out of their home and living on the streets in the wintertime, there's a camp in a valley in Utah called Safe and Sound, and they have the biggest request of the homeless youth that are living in these tents there. The laws are stated as such in Utah that underage kids can't go to homeless shelters. So Safe and Sound offers them shelter and protection with tents. It's the best they can do. They can't offer a permanent structure. So their greatest request is a piece of board, like wood board, so they don't have to sleep on the frozen ground. And these are your deacons and your priests passing you the sacrament, and they're thrown out. And that is unacceptable to me. If I had a big enough home, I would take them all in. You know I would. Mm-hmm. But that was very disappointing for me when I heard that. Never, ever crossed my mind to throw my child out.
Yeah, I agree. And the weird thing is, I think it's happening from loving parents who honestly feel that they're doing their child a favor.
Yes, it is not taught over the pulpit to throw your child out of the home. That's not what the LDS Church would teach. But for some reason, parents, I've heard of parents kicking their child out to give them some tough love, come back once you're straight, or, you know, and they feel like they're honestly doing the best thing for them. And that's really kind of the saddest part.
Yeah. And it goes to what I was saying, is I think I'm just thinking as a priesthood holder in the home, if I was going to do that, I'm just trying to justify of the thought process is you're told that a gay lifestyle, being gay or whatever, is not, it's not right. You know, you can't make that choice in life and receive salvation. And so all that you know, well, okay, if you can't do that, well, then the only way to receive exaltation completely is if you end up straight eventually, you know, at some level. And so I think a lot of parents are like, well, I'm going to teach them really young that their path that they're on right now won't get them anywhere. You know, hopefully if I show them tough love, that'll turn them around. And that's the biggest, it's a conundrum really of because there is no pathway for the gay youth. There's not a pamphlet, you know, that tells you, you know, what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do. It's just one that says, it's just one for all the straight kids to say what, you know, that if you're gay, you know, you can't do any of this. But it's, and I don't think parents know what to do, you know, and I don't, you know, that's why I feel lucky for the, gift that we've kind of been given, because mm-hmm. I mean, we could have easily been like any other parent out there, and I don't know why we weren't, but I'm glad for John's sake. So
mm-hmm. So we came out to the ward, we just with a letter, we just starting the process of coming out. We started with my family, and it was very well received. My family was very loving, and then we came out to the ward. We got a lot of positive feedback from the ward, but I wondered the coming up fast Sunday, what might be said or what messages received. And I just wanted John to be left with a message of love from his mom. And so I sprinted to the pulpit. I was the first one up there. And I shared an experience that I'd had just the day before. It was a Saturday. I was trying to get somewhere really quickly, but I was stuck in traffic and I was getting all frustrated that I was stuck in traffic. But I noticed that there was a man on the side of the road that was asking for money, and he was homeless. And usually I would hear the voice of my father in my head saying, he's just going to use that to buy beer or, you know, or whatever. But I just thought that, you know, at that moment, like, whoa, what would Jesus do? And so I rolled the window down and I thought I was giving him a dollar, and I saw that it was $5, and I felt even better. And I was giving to him, and I thought, why have I been, this feels amazing to give and just to love. And who cares if he's going to go buy beer? Who cares what he's going to do with it? But it's my responsibility to feel love and take care of my fellow man. So I was bearing my testimony on this, and I said, Jesus, when he healed a lame man, he didn't immediately say, now what are you going to do with those legs? Are you going to do good deeds with those legs? There were no circumstances to his love. It wasn't conditional. It was just, he just healed and he gave love. And so I finished my testimony with that Jesus said, love thy neighbor. Who is our neighbor? Everyone. And I sat down and I, you know, said in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. And I sat down and I didn't say anything about John. I didn't really say any messages, but I just wanted a message of unconditional love, and that message, that beautiful message that we get from Christ and Christ's teachings.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a monthly subscriber at mormonstories.org. Music for this episode was provided by the Lower Lights.
When other sources cease to make me whole, when with a wounded heart, anger or malice, I draw